give them a round of applause for the meal this evening. And next up, our county co-chairman, Jeff Ortez, is going to give a short history of Judge Joseph Story and why we chose the name chose to honor him at dinner 7 years ago when we started the event.
All right, thank you, Brett. And thank you, everyone here tonight. Wow, what a wonderful turnout. Thank you, Senator Sass, Governor Reynolds, Lieutenant Governor Gregg. Thank you all. And as Brett mentioned, we're at the 7th Annual Judge Joseph Story Dinner. You might want to know a little bit about Joseph Story. He was born on September 18, 1779, died September 10, 1845. He was an American lawyer and jurist who served on the Supreme Court of the United States from 1811 to 1845. He is most remembered for his opinions in Martin versus Hunter's lessee and Amistad case. And if that Amistad case sounds familiar, Steven Spielberg did a movie about that. And especially for his magisterial commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, first published in 1833. Dominating the field in the 19th century, this work is a cornerstone of early American jurisprudence. It's the second comprehensive treaty on the provisions of the U.S. Constitution and remains a critical source of historical information about the forming of the Republic and the early struggles to define its law. In November 1811, at the age of 32, Story became the youngest Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. President James Madison nominated Story on November 15, 1811, to a seat vacated by William Cushing. John Quincy Adams was Madison's previous choice for his seat, but he declined, finding his service as a diplomat in Russia more rewarding and more useful to the United States. The United States Senate confirmed Story's nomination, and Madison signed his commission on November 18, 1811. Story swore his oath and assumed office on February 3, 1812. Story remains the youngest Supreme Court justice at appointment. Here he found a congenial home for the brilliance of his scholarship and the development and expression of his political philosophy. I'd like to share one quote from him, too, that I find very poignant. "No one appreciates more fully than myself the general importance of the study of law. No one places a higher value upon that science as a great instrument by which society is held together and the cause of public justice is maintained and vindicated. Without it, neither liberty, nor property, nor life, nor that which is even dearer than life, a good reputation, is for a moment secure. It is, in short, the greatest elastic power which pervades and embraces every human relation. It links man to man by so many mutual ties and duties and dependencies that, though often silent and unseen in its operation, it becomes at once the minister of his social necessities and a guardian of his social virtues. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your evening."
And now I have the great honor and pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening. While I also usually prefer to keep Cornhusker fans on their side of the Missouri River, we're going to make an exception tonight for Senator Sass here. And Senator Sass was first elected to the United States Senate from Nebraska in 2014 and quickly earned a reputation for thinking deeply and speaking boldly about the challenges we face as a nation. His ability to articulate conservative issues and engage with voters is truly extraordinary. And I was thinking a lot about what to say to introduce the senator this evening. And if you follow his Twitter feed, you'll learn he has a soft spot for the Canadian rock band Nickelback. But I decided not to use their lyrics tonight because I thought it would be cruel to the audience. So instead, he went on CNN the other day, and I know some of you saw that, to talk about a bet that he likes to make since joining the Senate about the outcome between the football game between the University of Nebraska and the University of Iowa. So he's got to make that bet a couple years now, and I won't point out how many times he's won. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure he chose... Yeah. I'm pretty sure he thought that Story County was safe from getting mocked by a Hawkeye fan, but he was wrong about that, so... I had to give him a little bit of trouble tonight, and so the consequence of the bet this year was he has to drive Uber in Iowa tonight. So that was part of losing the bet. So Senator, I did get you a little something for your Uber shift later tonight. So if you want to come up, I can go ahead and present that to you. So I know part of it was you were supposed to drive Uber with Hawkeye gear. So. So I have to get a couple pictures here. So nothing unites Iowans, Cyclones and Hawkeyes like making fun of Nebraska. So we had to do that tonight. So. Thank you. And as a nicer gift, we do have one of our Story County Republican shirts. So that you'll probably wear more often. Yeah. It goes with the rest of your wardrobe. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow, that was a painful way to start. There's so much humbling that I have to go through over the next few hours. I like to work, and I like to work with Nebraskans and Americans and constituents. And so in addition to regular town hall type tours, I do a lot of field work. And sometimes in an ag state like yours or like mine, that means you get to get really dirty. And I've done a lot of that this week. I had my hand involved in helping crack or break 1.3 million eggs this week at an egg processing plant. Almost all 1.3 million were on purpose. There were a couple of places where I messed up the assembly line. But I'm also fascinated, and we'll talk a little bit tonight, about some of the disruption of the new digital, mobile, portable, shorter-term sharing economy. And that got me driving Uber last fall. And I found that driving Uber after Husker football games in downtown Lincoln was a good way to get to know a lot of your constituents, most of them sober. Along the way, I don't do work tours and work events for press purposes. I do it to learn about people's jobs and to get to know Nebraskans. But it turned out a bunch of reporters figured out as some of this stuff went viral that I was driving Uber. Nobody wrote about it. Nationally they did, but nobody wrote about it locally in Nebraska until a couple months later when a couple things happened in the development of the political landscape in Nebraska, and I had said a few things that got me in trouble, and other things happened. And the Omaha World Herald decided to write a story on my Uber driving with the headline, Senator Sass Explores Fallback Career Options. So I am not in Des Moines tonight when I leave Nevada. Again, for the national press, we understand that it's spelled Nevada, but it's pronounced Nevada here. When I head to Des Moines tonight to drive Uber, it is not because I am looking for a job. It is because I am paying back the debt for the Huskers having unfortunately lost 2 years in a row to the Hawkeyes. And so if you hear reports, no clapping required, thanks a lot. If you hear reports tonight of an Uber driver wearing lots of yellow and black and weeping uncontrollably, that'll be me. So that's what my evening holds. So we have about a half an hour tonight. And thank you for having me, and Brett, thank you for the invitation. It isn't accidental that I ended up in this area. Once I had to be wearing Hawkeye gear, I thought go to the Cyclone territory and see if people mock me less. But back before we started this event, it turned out there were equal opportunity mockers from both of your schools. But in addition to Brett, I'd like to acknowledge your governor, and thank you for being here and for your kind words this last week, and your lieutenant governor here as well. So thank you, Kim. Good to be with all of you. I want to spend our half an hour, a pretty decent chunk of it, in question and answer, but I would like to frame it up first. I think we live in really, really extraordinary times in terms of the challenges that our nation faces. There are lots of theoretical, reasonable reasons to be pessimistic about a lot of the challenges we face. But I am dispositionally an optimist, and so I hope you hear tonight, even though we're going to identify a bunch of problem spots in our country, and by country I mean things that are lots bigger than just our politics. I don't want to limit our discussion to just politics tonight, but I hope you hear, even in the midst of a laundry list of some of the challenges we face, I hope you hear dispositional optimism, because this is the most extraordinary nation in the history of the world. When we say... When we say American exceptionalism, it means something that's really precise, and contrary to what our last president said, it isn't something that you say yes to and say, well, I believe in American exceptionalism probably the way Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism or Brits believe in British exceptionalism. It's something different than that. A claim about American exceptionalism and imbuing your kids and our students and the rising generation with a sense of what is exceptional about America is not in any way an ethnic claim. It's not a claim about the superiority of Americans individually, morally, than other people on the earth. It's not some sort of tribal or parochial claim. It's a historical acknowledgement about something that we celebrated 3 days ago. in Iowa with fireworks for the first time in a while, I think I hear. But 241 years ago, at the Declaration of Independence, and in the course of the next 11, 12, 13 years, as there was a big national wrestling with what would it mean to form a country that's based on an idea. Remember the great Margaret Thatcher line that America is different than other nations, and she was saying in particular, America is different than Europe because Europe is a continent, it's a group of nations based on history. She said that America is the first nation, it's the first modern nation in the history of the world founded on philosophy. What does that mean? It means that America is a creedal nation. Our founders believed a little bit at the Declaration, clearly in the Declaration, but a little bit as a national moment, but there was also a specific set of grievances. If you read the Declaration again, and it's a good tradition, by the way, I urge you, on July 4th, if you want to pass this on next year, resolve now for your kids and grandkids. It only takes about 10 minutes. Read the Declaration before you start setting off fireworks at your house. The first couple of paragraphs are really extraordinary, and they're worth reading at least once a year. And it explains that we hold certain truths. This is not subjective stuff. We believe these are truths. We believe they're self-evident truths. That all men and women are created equal. That they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when you go from that declaration and you fast forward to the Constitution, argued about a lot in Philadelphia in 1787, and then the ratification debates of 1787 and 1788, what was happening in this country is our forefathers, our founders, our forefathers and foremothers made a claim that was really, really arrogant. It was an incredibly hubristic thing to say, as they did. We actually think most people in the history of the world have been wrong about what government is. Our founders said, we think most people in the history of the world thought governments came first and governments gave us rights. And we, the people, we weren't citizens. People were supposedly dependent subjects, and you had to wait for government to give you certain freedoms. And if you didn't get them, the passive assumption was prohibition. Things are prohibited unless they're permitted by the government, most times and places in human history. And our founders said, I know this is kind of bold, but we think that's wrong. We think that government doesn't give us rights. We think that God gives us rights by nature. We have these inalienable rights, and we think that government is just our shared project to secure those rights. Government is a tool. Government is something we, the people, build. We give the government limited and enumerated powers. The government doesn't give us rights, which is why the Constitution. All right. Which is why the Constitution is such an extraordinary document. Because almost every foundational document of a government ever is the government explaining what rights you get. And if the government doesn't give them to you, you don't have them. Our Constitution is almost exclusively a negative document. The Constitution is us explaining what limited powers we give to the government, and then it stops. It doesn't explain where our rights come from. The Declaration already said they come from God. We believe they're inalienable rights. And the Constitution doesn't really bother with that. You say, what do you mean the Constitution doesn't tell us about our rights? What about the Bill of Rights? It is a really important thing that we teach our kids why the Bill of Rights is outside the main body of the document. The Bill of Rights is just a didactic tool. It's just an educational list to say, hey, by the way, since our Constitution is us, the people, telling the government what powers it gets, and if it doesn't get any more, it doesn't get any more than those that we explicitly give it here. The government isn't the author or source of our rights, but just so that nobody ever gets confused, let's go ahead and list a bunch of them outside the document just so we can use it as kind of a catechism. It's just a way to teach your kids. So let's list a bunch of the rights. And so when you think about the 10, the Bill of Rights, you think about the structure of that, think where it starts. So if you're going to list and you're going to teach your kids, what's the first thing? What's the first right? What's the one thing that comes before all the others? You can't do it. Right? The First Amendment is a laundry list. Speech, press, religion, assembly, the right of redress of grievances. It's like a big dog's breakfast. You can't have freedom of religion if you didn't have freedom of assembly. You can't have freedom of speech if you don't have the freedom of the press. If you can't promulgate and publish and write down and have people who aren't with us in this room tonight also get to read what we want to argue about, what we want to teach to the next generation. You can't have these freedoms of press and religion and speech without protest, without being able to go to the government and say, you're wrong, you're overstepping, which, by the way, is what most of the Declaration does, explain all that King George was doing wrong and usurping his authorities. And then you go to the Second Amendment, and it's to secure the First Amendment, and you run through this list, and you get to the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, and where does it end up? The Ninth and Tenth Amendment are a big screaming commercial that there's no end to the list of your rights. What the Ninth and Tenth Amendments say is, if we didn't tell you all of your rights, if we didn't talk about them, you still get all of those too. And if the government wasn't given a specific power, if the federal government wasn't, then they're powers that could only be exercised by the states and local governments. Because government is limited, and our natural rights are limitless. That's what America means. It's an idea. It's an extraordinary thing. And we have to do the hard work of tending to that and passing it on to the next generation. And when I say we, I mean we in this room. Because fundamentally, America is not about Washington, D.C. The center of America is not the place where professional full-time politicians go and get their paychecks. But you'd be reasonable for being confused about that right now when 5 of the 7 richest counties in America are the suburbs of Washington, D.C., where the lobbyists live. The 7 richest places in America today are Manhattan, San Francisco, and 5 counties ringing Maryland and Virginia, circling Washington, D.C., because we are consolidating more and more and more of our power and more of our national conversation in Washington, D.C. That will not serve us well. That was not what America was intended to do. And so the most fundamental things about America are associational. They're relational. They're in Nevada, and they're in Ames, and heaven forfend, they're in Iowa City. But they're really, the center of the world is supposed to be Fremont, Nebraska. It's supposed to be the place where you raise your kids, where you worship, where you start a small business, where you join the Rotary Club, where you volunteer in the Little League and on the volunteer fire department. That's the center of the world, because the things that actually make people happy are the things that you build and the things that you invest in, the things that you love. What matters in life is ultimately your habits and your appetites and your loves. Now, that's not to say that government isn't necessary, but it is to say that government is in a public servant role. The purpose of the federal government is to maintain a framework for ordered liberty so you can live right life right here in Nevada, free from certain kinds of fears and worries of things that can erode and invade from afar. But the center of the world can never actually be Washington, D.C. The problem is, right now, we are seeing a massive hollowing out of local community. At the same time, we're trying to politicize almost all national conversation. And so people feel more and more disconnected from the places they're from. We've got huge generational challenges before us, and we're not talking about those big challenges. Some of them are political. Some of them have a political component. But most of what's really important in life is local. And most of the really big challenges that we face are way upstream from politics. And so I stand before you as a newbie. I'm one of 5 people in the U.S. Senate who's never been a politician before. And I'm a business turnaround guy and college president by background. But I ran for office because I want to displace the seat that I hold from somebody else who might be addicted to politics. Because I don't think America can work well if you have a whole bunch of people trying to be in public servant roles that think Washington's the center of the world, that think that government might be the author of your rights, and that have a 3 cheers for government view of the world. I have a 1 cheer of government view of the world. Government is important, it is necessary, but it's just a means to the things that are really important. And so most of what we worry about, most of what we think about, most of what we invest our hopes and our dreams in, shouldn't be about politics. And I'm a localist. I'm a pluralist. I believe in markets. I believe in as much decentralization as you can possibly have. So I stand before you as the guy with the 3rd most conservative voting record in the Senate. So don't mishear what I'm going to say next as an argument for a mushy middle. Because there's nobody more conservative than I am in the U.S. Senate in terms of wanting decentralized localist solutions. But most of the really big problems that we face right now really aren't Republican versus Democrat, because neither of these parties are actually that interesting. I'm really glad that you all invest the way you do at the local level in an institution like this. I am happily a member of the party of Abraham Lincoln. I believe in equal dignity. I believe in the origins of this party. I believe in Lincoln and Douglas, not Lincoln-Douglas debates, though those were good, though really quite overblown historically. Do any of us really want to listen to politicians argue for 3.5 hours? I don't think so. But I mean Frederick Douglass. I mean Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and what this party is founded on is really, really special stuff. And yet, none of us should have that much of our identity invested in a political party, because the more important titles that you bear are not Republican. They're mom and dad and neighbor and Christian, or whatever your faith tradition is. I'm giving you mine. Dad and Husker fan. And if you people are confused about this, we can talk more afterwards. And conservative is an identity marker for me that's prior to Republican. And American and Nebraskan. We've all got a whole bunch of different hats to wear. And I am very happily a member of the party of Abraham Lincoln. But only if the party of Abraham Lincoln, the Republican Party, understands that the only way you can be a really good Republican is by wanting to be a great American first. Because fundamentally, the challenges that we face together are much bigger than the policy fights that we're going to have. Here's the challenge. In Washington right now, as we centralize more and more of our identities and our tribes around politics and parties, Washington is going to fail you. Washington is filled with people that don't have a long-term vision, even for policy and politics, let alone for the challenges the country faces. I want to give you a few generational issues I think we face, some of the struggles that we need to have together as a people the next 5 to 10 years. And I won't be exhaustive in building out my sort of problematizing and my original solution set on some of these, because I'll let you lead us there in question and answer. You can decide which things we drill down more deeply on. But we've got lots of generational challenges before us. Again, many of the things I'm going to say are not precisely political, but we don't have a national security strategy for the age of cyber and jihad. We don't have any real theory for what the world looks like when there are lots of non-state actors that have the potential to have global reach. We're 28 years since the fall of the wall in Berlin. We're 26 years since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the ostensible end of the Cold War. 26 years. And yet, we don't have any real national security strategy of thinking about an era when lots of bad guys, not just Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, but jihadis and other people that will occupy ungoverned spaces and vacuums across the 40 to 50 to 60 of the 200 countries across the globe that don't really have a monopoly on violence inside their own territory. These are not just jihadi groups. They're international organized crime groups. And if you have 50 or 250 or 500 really good programmers, pretty soon you're going to be able to act like a nation state in terms of the way you wage cyber war. And we are completely underinvested in this question, not only financially, but in terms of national mindshare. When you think about the development of nuclear strategy in the late 1940s, we realized we had a big challenge, but by the late 1950s, we had a strategy. It took about a decade, 10 to 13 years, depending on how you want to count. We are now almost 30 years since the development of cyber tools, worms and viruses, that have now accelerated rapidly in the last 5 to 10 years. We're 30 years into this, we have no strategy for it, and ultimately the challenges of cyber are much bigger than the challenges of the nuclear era, because the barriers to entry are low. You're going to have lots more cyber war potential across the globe than nuclear war makers from the late 1940s or early 1950s, and you're going to have big attribution problems. That's something DC should be focused on, and we're not serious about it. We don't have an offensive or a defensive doctrine. We don't have a theory of what comes next in an era where job duration is going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. We live at a very interesting moment in economic history. If you want to do this at the macro level, you had hunter-gatherers, you had settled agrarianism 11,000 years ago. I don't mean what you do as high-tech farming in Iowa today or we do in Nebraska today. I mean the beginning of planting and harvesting 11,000 years ago. Sort of phase two of economic history was agriculture. Phase three was industrialization, about about 150 years ago. And by the 1920s or 30s, we had a theory of what big cities and big tool economies looked like. We're entering a fourth phase of economic history. There were hunter-gatherers, there were farmers, there were factories, and now there's this new thing that we don't even know what to call it. Sometimes we call it the mobile economy, the digital economy, the service economy, the IT economy. Sociologists have just given up now, and they call it the post-industrial economy, which is a way of calling it the after-the-last-thing. Right? This would be like if instead of having industrialization as a category, we tried to say, well, there was the post-agricultural economy. There was the de-agriculturalization economy. We're entering a world where for the first time in human history, almost everyone is going to work in sectors where not just your job and not just your firm, but maybe your whole industry will cease to exist when you're 40 or 45 or 50 or 55 years old. That has never happened before in human history. We're going to have to create a civilization of lifelong learners. The potential of this moment is actually fascinating. The IT economy. I'm driving Uber tonight. I'm really glad that Uber exists. I think it's a fascinating business model. I'm glad for some of the stuff that it's disrupting. But when you see the disruption that's going to come to almost every sector of the economy in the next 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years, we're going to have to rethink a whole bunch of fundamental questions, many of which are policy, but most of which are pre-political and far more important than policy and politics, which is when you had hunter-gatherers, when you had nomads, those people lived in extended kinship networks where they wandered the great plains of this region for, you know, their whole lives together, and they knew their fifth cousins versus their sixth cousins. There was a social network. There was relationality based on being nomads and tracking the same buffalo. When you had people settling down to farm for the first time, you created the villages of places like Iowa and Nebraska, but quintessentially the sort of New England villages that we think of at the time of the American founding. We knew what neighborliness looked like. When you had industrialization, lots of people were afraid that the American experiment wouldn't work because as people left small villages and went to cities, they might ultimately not ever have neighborly accountability again. They might not ever have known relationships. Happily, everybody across the political spectrum, Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt and Democrats like Woodrow Wilson, they were wrong that America wouldn't be able to navigate into the industrial era. What they thought would be this huge disruption turned out to not be so because the industrial era created urban ethnic neighborhoods where neighbors knew each other again and there was some density to those relationships. We're entering an age where people's jobs are going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. And I was born in 1972. In the mid-1970s, average duration at a firm was almost 3 decades. Today, it's 3.8 years. And it's going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. Work is one of the most fundamental anchors of human identity, and lots of us are going to have bigger doubts about whether we're needed. There's almost nothing more important than whether or not on Monday morning you're leaving home and going somewhere where you think you actually matter in the world because you can live a life of gratitude to God by doing some work that benefits some neighbor. What if we have a world where far more people think that their work is less and less relevant and that they're less needed? You know what that produces? That produces a crisis of loneliness, and we're seeing the front edges of that wave right now. If you think of a friend, not a Facebook friend, not somebody that you know socially, but a friend as someone who loves you enough that when you hurt, they hurt. The way you parent, right? When one of my kids are 15, 13, and 6, when one of my kids is hurting, I don't choose to hurt. I just hurt because I love them, right? Their pain, it's my pain. I can't not feel it. When they're happy, my chest expands. Like, life is great. That's what a friend is, right? A friend is someone who has an expansive sense of their self, that when you're happy, they're happy. When you're sad, they're sad. They feel it. The average American has gone from 3.4 friends 25 years ago to about 1.8 today. We've seen a halving of friendship in America in the last 25 years. This is a crisis that our politics can't possibly solve. The 535 people I work with, we're not nearly interesting enough to solve these problems. But we should be able to talk about them. We should be able to recognize that the disruption of work is going to completely remake, or it needs to completely remake, the way we think about education, and particularly higher education, and job retraining. We should be able to recognize that the number one driver of growing uninsurance in America is not socioeconomic status. It's not pre-existing medical conditions. Both of these are important problems that we should talk about. But when you ask national journalists, or you'll ask politicians, or you'll ask man and woman on the street kinds of questions, what's wrong in American healthcare? They know that it's costs and it's uninsurance. But then when we talk about uninsurance, we give a whole bunch of reasons that aren't the real reason. The number one reason for growing uninsurance in America is more rapid job change. Statistically, when you change jobs every 3.8 years, you have 4 to 6 months of uninsurance at the moment you're changing jobs. Well, that's when you get the breast cancer diagnosis. That's when you get in the car wreck, and now you're the pre-existing condition population of 3 and 5 and 10 years from now. Our politics is not tackling any of this. I don't want to talk narrowly about policy much tonight, but I'll maybe detour for 1 second because I'm still hot about, I'm frustrated about the developments of this week in the healthcare debate. When I say that I think neither of these parties are interesting enough, I'll give you a case in point. For 7 years, the party that we're all a part of in this room has said that it was for the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. For 7 years, this party has been for the repeal and replace of Obamacare. The president just ran and won on it. There are 52 Republicans in the Senate. 51 of us have pledged to repeal Obamacare. 51 of us have voted in the past to repeal Obamacare when it was going to go to President Obama's desk and he was going to veto it, as he did in November, December of 2015. You know what the Republican Party appears to be deciding over the course of the last week? Well, it's going to be really hard to repeal and replace Obamacare at once to get 50 of 52 votes plus the vice president to do that. I acknowledge it is really hard to do that, to get to agreement on what a replace plan looks like. And so what if you might not be able to succeed at repealing and replacing in the same package deal? What would a rational person who'd made a bunch of pledges do? You'd say, well, then maybe we ought to separate these steps. Maybe we ought to go ahead and keep our word on repeal, and maybe we ought to pass a law that says the effective date of this is 12 or 24 months in the future, and then we ought to move on to the next step of replace, and we ought to not leave D.C. until we finish the work. One of 52 Republicans ran on the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And if we can't get repeal and replace done at the same time, we ought to repeal, and then we ought to get to work on replace, and the American people ought to know we mean it by us not doing anything else. We ought to do it on camera, 18 hours a day, 6 days a week, in the heat of August. So what? I would rather be in Nebraska in August doing work tours and driving Uber and going to Husker early, you know, preseason practice. But we have a job to do. And if we can't replace it and repeal at the same time, then repeal the law and stay and work on replace full time. Instead, what is the Republican Party deciding to send national signals about over the course of the last 48 or 72 hours? Well, if we can't repeal and replace at once, then maybe we should just start working with Democrats to fix Obamacare. Though that is the exact opposite of what we ran on. It's bad policy. It's bad politics, but it's also just fundamentally deciding that keeping your word is not something you need to take very seriously. Well, as one of the five people who's never been a politician before, one of the reasons I'm doing this is because I think that city doesn't take seriously enough the keeping of its word. And when I give my word I'm going to do something, I want to stay there and do that work. And we should have to have a conversation in front of the American people where we explain why are costs so out of control in American health. Because the answer isn't that there hasn't been enough government intervention in the past. There is a reason why healthcare costs grow at 2 to 2.5 times inflationary growth year over year over year over year since the mid-1960s. We have decades of healthcare costs going up. And every time the government tinkers more and doesn't solve the problem, the assumed answer is always, well, we must not have tinkered enough. The assumption to more government intervention that doesn't work is always still more government intervention. That's insanity. And so I want my party to be the party that explains the really hard stuff about why, even though there isn't today agreement on repeal and replace, we're going to do repeal, then we're going to get to work on replace, and oh, by the way, we should pause and connect this to the larger structural stuff that's actually happening, which is that if you work for a larger employer group, you have a tax accident that allows you to get insurance that's tax subsidized in a way that Iowa farmers and ranchers and small business people don't get. And yet the jobs of the future are going to be much more connected to people who are connected to small organizations and innovative startups and sharing economy jobs and the disruption of age 40 and 45 and 50 and 55. We need to be having these conversations. Again, only a subset of these are political and policy, but the upstream effects are going to have a huge effect on the national conversation about what Republican virtue means. By Republican, I mean small r Republican virtue. I don't mean the Republican Party. I mean the civic republicanism that defines why America believes in limited government and believes that the government exists to serve us and that communities like this are the center of the world. Communities like this don't exist to serve Washington. And then last, and I'll pull up here, but I think we have to recognize that we have a crisis of civics in our time. There's a lot more stuff we could talk about. There's nothing more important than the breakdown of family structures in America right now. But we can't cover everything here tonight. But most of the things that really matter in life are well upstream from politics. But a place where our culture and our politics come together is whether or not we do civics, whether or not our kids understand that First Amendment we were talking about earlier. And right now the data shows that they don't. 41% of Americans under age 35 tell pollsters that they believe that the First Amendment might be dangerous. What? 41% of Americans under age 35 say the First Amendment might be dangerous because you might use your freedom of speech to say something that would hurt someone else's feelings. And so we need our college campuses to be driven by safe spaces, not by actual debate and learning. Although encountering ideas you didn't already agree with is kind of what education is. It turns out you may not agree with every new idea. You may sometimes be persuaded. You may sometimes decide that new idea you encountered is wrong. But as you figure out how to engage it and wrestle with it, that's what education looks like, right? Well, that understanding of the First Amendment, that understanding of why we have free speech, press, religion, assembly, and protest is another way of saying we don't agree on all the ultimate things. Our forefathers and foremothers fought about heaven and hell, and they decided that when they come together, what they want to do is make sure that our politics first define a space that's free from violence so that we can argue about the really important stuff, your appetites and your affections and your habits and your theology and your loves. The really important stuff in life is the stuff that you do around the town square, over the dinner table, inviting people to worship with you, trying to persuade them to buy your product or to join your Rotary Club or your venture philanthropy project. Those are the really important things in life. And our public square is supposed to be free from violence so that you can be free, too, trying to persuade other people. That's what America means. In other words, having to encounter ideas you don't already agree with is the purpose of our politics. You're free from violence so you can be free, too, the really big stuff. We got lots and lots of challenges before us, but what we need to do is have people like you in a community like this and involved in the Republican Party as you are here in Nevada and in Ames and in Story County, wanting to say, I want to be a great Republican by recognizing that my Republicanism, that part of my identity, is probably issue 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. And the really important stuff is well upstream for that. Thanks for having me tonight. Look forward to having questions. Who's up? And as long as it's not football, I'll call on you. Yes, sir. Oh, that's good. I didn't know we were going to get to do Old Home Week. My wife, Melissa, is an Air Force brat, but grew up mostly in Alabama. And she had some friends who went to school with me in Boston. I wasn't good enough to play sports for the Huskers. So I had to go off to school in Boston where they had crappy athletics and they'd let me play. And she had some friends that went to school in Boston. And we got to know each other that way and then did some short-term mission trips together when we were in college. Yes? Thanks. I've been doing field and work tours across Nebraska this week. I am in Iowa for two reasons. I'm glad to be in Story County tonight. But the two things that actually first brought me are that my kids are doing a triathlon in Des Moines tomorrow. And I had to pay my Uber bet before the the football season began. So we batched up me driving Uber tonight with my kids doing a triathlon tomorrow, and then this invitation hit that window as well. Sir. Yes, sir. Thanks. Lots of big and important stuff there. The disintermediation of the economy at this stage, I'll bracket here and speak just to your healthcare point. But one of the problems we have in our healthcare discussions is that we don't distinguish between insurance and the sort of collectivized prepayment of largely predictable and or behaviorally driven expenses, many of which are really expensive, really catastrophic, and a lot that we should debate. But one of the things that we don't do well is we don't explain, we don't debate together, why does health insurance work so poorly? One of the fundamental reasons health insurance works poorly is we try to use it as collectivized prepayment for everything, and no other insured marketplace works that way. Imagine in property and casualty insurance if you tried to do what we do in health insurance. What that would look like is you would pass a law that mandates that Allstate and State Farm have to buy all your gas and schedule all your Jiffy Lube appointments. If you pass that law, I submit to you what will happen is that Jiffy Lube won't be open the right hours, it won't be at the right locations, the customer service will be far worse than it is, you won't have clear quality metrics about what services they provide, and definitely the costs will skyrocket. As long as they're being able to charge that through to some big insurance company in the middle, which is passing it on to you, it won't work. And so right now, we don't really have health insurance. We have collectivization of all medical expenditures. And it isn't just that healthcare is the largest sector of the U.S. economy. When you disaggregate five parts of it, hospitals, med device, pharma, insurance or financing, and human capital, docs, nurses, and all the med techs and all the other employees in the space, all five of those are among the 11 or 12 biggest industries of the U.S. economy. And so we bundle it together, and we don't get higher quality, lower cost over time as we get in every other sector of the economy. Arguably, parts of education suffer from things that are really similar to what doesn't work in healthcare, and some of that is because it's also dominated by third-party payment that's largely governmental. So I'm all for us tackling these problems. We need to unbundle lots of big conversations and get down to some of what you were flagging about the individual insurance market. We have a large employer group market. We have a seniors market in Medicare. We have a safety net program in Medicaid that doesn't work nearly as well as it should. And then we've got the individual market that Obamacare has largely decimated. And so when you hear people talk nationally about Obamacare and the repeal of it, a lot of national journalists sort of cover those stories as if the only thing that Obamacare did was help the specific people that it helped. And I believe that Obamacare has helped a number of particular people, and we shouldn't toss those people off their insurance. That's why I'm so enthusiastically in favor of a replace conversation that says DC should tackle this with a new kind of urgency and should not leave town until people who are the poorest and sickest among us, or those who got care because of Obamacare, feel that there's some comfort about what comes next in a post-Obamacare environment. But those national conversations that only focus on the benefits of the new population tend to be completely unaware of the way Obamacare has decimated the individual insurance markets in places like Iowa and Nebraska. As I've been traveling the state this week, again and again, you have farmers and ranchers coming up to you talking about needing to pay between $20,000 and $30,000 a year for a family of four to be insured on the individual market now. It was a mess before Obamacare. Republicans are making a mistake when we pretend that everything that's wrong in healthcare is driven just by Obamacare. But it wasn't that. And so the disastrous attack on the individual insurance market is one of the things that happens when you do insurance this way. Sir. Yeah, so I think that taxes are not as complicated as healthcare, but only by a smidge less, right? So first, what I would like to do is distinguish between, before we decide how much taxes we're going to raise and from whom, we should have clarity about what we're spending on at the federal level and why. So I'm not going to duck your question, but I want to talk more about this other point. So let me just say briefly, I think we obviously have a system that doesn't make sense where people have the kinds of incentivized reasons to do tax avoidance that most people have. We could have a tax system that would generate the same revenue with lower marginal rates if we carved out lots of the loopholes and special exemptions that incentivize people to try to avoid paying taxes through all these intricate complex things. The total waste economically and in terms of man hours from that is extraordinary. So we should have a much simpler tax code. I'm for fundamental tax reform that would lower the rates and broaden the base and carve out loopholes and special exemptions. I'm sort of slightly skeptical that we're not going to do truly comprehensive tax reform this year, and it'll end up being tinkering. A whole bunch of things happen between now and September 30th when the fiscal year ends. We have to fund the government for next year. We have to pass the National Defense Authorization Act. We should be doing almost nothing but Obamacare repeal and replace. So I'm skeptical of fundamental comprehensive tax reform happening now. But I think the way to get to a real broadly engaged public on taxes would be to understand, what does the government spend its money on? I'm going to give you a quick historical snapshot. I promise I won't go full history nerd on you. But in 1962, when Kennedy was president, we spent 52% of all national dollars on national security. More than half of all federal spending was national security. We spent 1% on health entitlements. That was when Kennedy was president. When Reagan was president, defense had gone from 52 to 30% of federal spending. Health entitlements had gone from 1 to 11. Today, we spend 71% of all that the federal government spends over the next decade on five mandatory programs or non-discretionary programs, meaning the federal government doesn't decide. The Congress doesn't decide to spend the money. These are just the things that are on autopilot. Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, Social Security, and interest on the debt. Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, three health entitlements, Social Security and interest on the debt are 71% of all federal spending. And the remaining 29% is half and half national security and not. So we've gone from 52% national security to 14, and we've gone from 1% on health entitlements to those entitlements plus Social Security and interest on the debt now being more than $2 out of every $3 the federal government spends. No matter what you do on taxes, you're ultimately going to bankrupt the next generation if you don't get health entitlements under control. And so to me, the prerequisite to any tax conversation is getting health entitlements right. And that requires distinguishing between having a welfare safety net for the poorest and sickest among us and getting to a place where there's portability in the health insurance market, where people can buy the coverage that they want. It can go with them across job and geographic change, because they're going to have lots more job change in the future. Last one. Yes, sir. Before you go on, let me just interrupt for a second. Can I make a request? Don't ever vote for a politician again who thinks that politics is the most important thing they do. Because fundamentally, if you're not a mom and a dad and a neighbor first, you're never going to be a good part-time politician. And that's what we're supposed to have in our system. Sorry. Yeah, great, great question. I will go back to some of the neighborliness stuff I said at the beginning, and maybe I'll use that as an occasion to flag our institutional robustness because of our history, right? Because of what Americans have always believed about all those plural relationships and institutions we have. I think we're having two big movements happen at the same time. We're hollowing out the local. People know their neighbors less, and they, I don't mean that in sort of an abstract way. Do you give each other, you know, a bundt cake every, you know, third month of the year? I mean, people have gone from neighborhoods where there was a density where you'd leave your kids with other people because there were enough shared values about the fact that before I'm a Republican or a Democrat on a policy issue, I don't want people driving too fast through my neighborhood because it might not be my kid, but it might be my neighbor's kid who gets hit, and we have something in common here. Robert Putnam, a guy who's not a conservative, doesn't agree with us on a lot of policy issues in this room. Nonetheless, well worth reading his book, not just Bowling Alone, which was a bestseller, you know, 15 years ago, a lot of people read. He has a new book out now called Our Kids. And what the term Our Kids meant to almost all Americans a few decades ago was something that was communal and neighborly. It was about the kids of Nevada. There are 7,000 people live here. That means there are however many kids of X, Y, and Z school age. When you talked about our kids, it meant we were in some of this together. Now, we could fight about tax policy. We could fight about how much EPA stuff is truly regulatory, that's interstate waterways versus what should be left local. But there was a sense of things that we shared and we had in common. Right now, we're seeing our jobs less and less connected to a place, and we're seeing a hollowing out of lots of institutions, and we're seeing more and more distrust of those institutions that we do have. I mean, Congress's approval rating and the media's approval rating and the judiciary's approval rating and the level of trust you have in the academy, institution after institution after institution in American life has declining public trust. And people are feeling less connection locally. Their jobs are less connected to where they are. Their jobs are going to be less durable. And at the same time, we're trying to take our national conversations and act like the really big and important things in life are Republican versus Democrat. They're not. These parties are not interesting enough to solve the really big problems. When you interview the American people right now, do you think of yourself more as a Republican or a Democrat? If you don't give them the choice of answering none of the above, still almost half of the public interrupts to say none of the above. About 46% of people say none of the above. About 29% Dem, about 25% R, and our party's older, so that's a problem. And then when you drill down the second level of that 54% that answers Republican versus Democrat, why are you a Republican or a Democrat? The main thing most people answer is because they're against the other one. It's not good enough for us to be Republicans because we're against Democrats. We have to be for a whole bunch of American stuff together first. And I think we have to recognize that the media that we face right now, and obviously there's lots of biased journalism and bad journalism out there. There's a lot of problems. But more fundamentally, what's really happening is there's a declining barrier to entry for new journalistic organizations. It's really hard to figure out what a business model looks like that isn't clickbait. And so lots and lots of national media has an incentive to sensationalize more and more and more and more. And as they do that, all they can ultimately do is traffic in rage. And we have lots of politicians that also think that it's our job just to drum people up with anger. I got three little kids. I don't go away four nights a week or five nights a week away from my kids to go somewhere else just to try to help make somebody angry, right? That doesn't solve any problem. What I want is an America that has a shared sense of what we believe in together as a people, and that needs to be limited government. That needs to be a sense that we limit government so that this can be the center of the world. The neighbor that you serve here, the kids and the grandkids that you're helping raise here, the kids of some family down the road that doesn't have a dad that you serve and try to love and invest in, those are the things that are ultimately rewarding in life, not what national political tribe we're a part of. And so for those of us who want to be great Republicans, we have to recognize that there's a whole bunch of our identity that's prior to our political allegiance. That's the way to make us not only better Republicans and better neighbors, but great Americans. Thanks for having me.